Session number 10688, Rule 2.
Mr. Kitson, Rule 2.
Diane, who became Commander in Chief, I'm repeating myself here, in the Seven Days' War, was leading light in the Stern Gang. The present Prime Minister was a member of the Stern Gang, and the chap before him was a member of the Irgun.
So you were talking about this in relation to your feelings about the village searches of the Arabs?
No, not necessarily. That was a separate sort of issue. The Irgun and the Stern Gang we're now taking up arms against us, against the British, against the army and the police. Not in the way they did later on, when they really went to town, but they were beginning to assert themselves and take actions that they were really, well, they were terrorists, if you call it. We were all terrorists, the Jews, the Arabs and the British. We all seemed to be employed in the same business. No, I never came in contact with Jewish terrorists at all. Whether it was because I was in places where they weren't, or in the urban districts. At that time, we didn't seem to have much trouble in the urban districts. Certainly not with the British police. Our main preoccupation then was with the so-called Arab terrorists, not the Jews.
So, was it this kind of the background to your reasons for leaving the Palestine Police?
No, not the main reason. The main reason was that before I went to Palestine, I came to the conclusion that there was going to be a war. But with the state of politics in this country and appeasement and all this sort of business, everybody seemed to think there wouldn't be a war. So off I went. When I got to Palestine, after I'd come out of the training depot, I began to notice things that inclined me to think that there definitely was going to be a war. Posters started to appear, where you would have a poster, teeth like Dracula, and a big whip. And he would be have an Arab on the ground, and he was thrashing the Arab with this whip, and the Arab, you could, and the poster, the Arab's back was all cut and bleeding, because the Germans, we knew eventually, were supporting the Arab terrorists. In fact, this chap Kawadji I mentioned a short time ago eventually left Palestine and as far as we understood, went to Germany. We did know later on that there was Arabs who'd been to Germany had been brought back to Palestine, but that was after I'd come home again. And this sort of thing came to my attention.
Who put these posters up?
Well, we never did know. The posters just suddenly appeared overnight. And that was quite simple because as time went on, we did less and less patrolling at night. Initially, we did foot patrols, as the police force would do in this country, two of us, an Arab or a Jew and a British constable, would patrol at night. But as time went on, this got less and less, so you didn't have the supervision you had originally, and these would just suddenly appear, these posters.
What kind of effect on police morale did these posters have?
No effect at all. Police morale was never low at any time when I was there. Never low. We enjoyed our job. We enjoyed the danger. There's no doubt about that. We enjoyed going out in a sweep where you went out with the dog handlers and the Doberman dogs. And that was a challenge to you. And we were trained, as I said, to peak of fitness. And as within the army, I enjoyed every minute in the army. And I enjoyed every minute. Some men might not have, I don't know, but morale was always high.
What were these sweeps?
Well, we would do sweeps in, with the army. We had a battalion of buffs outside Haifa, and they would send out army patrols. And we would join them because we knew the countryside better than they did. And they just swept through the countryside. Sometimes I used to wonder what they were looking for. I suppose that what they were looking for was a nest of terrorists, but we very seldom found them because they were more clever than we were. But we did a lot of that. I like going out with the dogs. You could go out for maybe 2 days, 3 days.
Were the dogs any use?
You couldn't compare them with the dogs that are used by police forces in this country. Dogs in this country are used for a whole lot of purposes. They follow a scent. The dogs there could follow a scent. But dogs in this country can be used for sniffing out drugs. They're specialists. The dogs there were useful when you searched the village, for example, and you lined up all the male population. The dogs were allowed to run. They ran free, and they didn't attack anybody. But they ran up and down beside the villagers who you had marshalled. And that sort of kept everybody in one place. The dogs were useful insofar that the Dobermann, and Dobermanns were used there, were dogs that nobody likes. People are afraid of Dobermanns. You've only got to produce a Doberman and people step back. Now, I've had Dobermann since I lived in this country. My Doberman died a few years ago. They're the most docile animals you could ever come across. But if you train them to be fierce, they'll be very fierce. My Doberman in the car, for example, if I left a car, I could leave it unlocked. You'd never steal my car, because if you put your hand in, it would tear the hand off you. In the car. Apart from that, they were docile. But the dogs there weren't. We wouldn't go near them. The dog handlers were trained in South Africa. They spoke to the dogs in Afrikaans. They were beautiful animals and well kept. And the very fact the dogs were with you gave you a boost to your morale, if you needed the boost. It's always welcome if you've got a dog like that with you in any operation, you know. But I never saw a dog there that followed the scent and we picked somebody up.
Did the dogs ever attack any villagers?
No. I never saw a dog attack anybody. They were extremely well trained. They were and obedient, as all police dogs are. What the command from the handler, the dog would sit down or lie down or come back or whatever it was. I never saw a dog attack anybody.
In these searches and sweeps, did you ever find anything significant?
I never was on a sweep where we found anything significant.
Or in any of the village searches, did you find arms?
No.
Did you personally ever have to open fire with your weapons whilst you were in Palestine?
On several occasions, I've opened fire with a Lewis gun. Whether there was a target for me to hit, or whether it was from nervousness, or what it was, I don't know. Because if you're on a hillside in the dark, every country's got different sounds. I found this in the desert, and I found it in Burma. And until you get to know these sounds and recognize the sounds, you're nervous, and you can become trigger happy. And I've heard sounds, I've been told to fire, and fired, without seeing a target. I've never been conscious I ever hit anybody. I've never been conscious there was even somebody there to hit. There probably was. But that didn't worry me. Open fire didn't worry me. Didn't during the war either. That was part of your training. That was part of your job. But of course there were very strict rules about firing. Although we were fully armed, the first thing we were taught in the depot was that you couldn't open fire, you couldn't fire at anybody unless you were attacked and your life was in danger and there were no other means whereby you could save your life. I've remembered that ever since then, 50 years ago. That was the rule. You must not open fire unless there was no other way to save your life. But of course, if somebody fired at you, or if you were in open country or rocky hillside, you would fire a weapon if you were told to fire it, or as I say, if you got a bit nervous or something like that. Purely as a defensive sort of thing. But as I say, I've never been conscious that I ever hit anybody.
Did you ever open fire in a city?
No, I haven't opened fire in a city. I've been in a city where firearms were used.
When was that?
That was in, I think in February 1937, when there was riots in Jaffa. The first I knew about it was, I think it was in the early hours of the morning, we were in a recruits training, we were turned out and loaded onto vehicles and taken there, and used to prevent Arabs in Jaffa invading or coming into Tel Aviv. And we spent a day there, and we had to prevent them by using physical force there. Eventually we were withdrawn because we were completely exhausted, and I didn't witness it, but I was in the town at the time when it was supposed to have happened, when at the end of the day the people, there was a lot of deaths, there was 200-300 people killed that day, not by us, but fighting between Arabs and Jews. And by the end of the day, apparently they were given orders to fire on the Palestinians. And the riot stopped.
You said the police were exhausted?
We were exhausted because we'd done a lot of baton charges.
Whilst you were there in Palestine, what kind of a job did you think British rule was doing there? Do you think it was doing a good job or not?
Under the circumstances, I think it was. You see, Palestine was a mandate from the League of Nations. So we were only really carrying out the mandate as the League of Nations wished it to be carried out. I always got the impression that the British in Palestine, particularly the very senior ranks, privately were very sympathetic towards the Palestinians. Nobody went about shouting the odds about it, but I always got that impression. But the League of Nations mandate gave us terrible problems. We were a strange nation in a strange country, trying to tell strangers what to do in their own country. We would have liked everything to have gone nice and smoothly and sweetly and that sort of thing. But how do you try to do that for years and years and years in a country which you're virtually occupying? It's a unique situation. You can't compare it with any other country in the world or any other sort of situation. You can't compare it with Northern Ireland because Northern Ireland, the people in Northern Ireland are Irish, and the people in Northern Ireland are British. But in Palestine, they weren't British. They were Arabs, and we were trying to impose something on them that the League of Nations wanted us to do. I think we did it as fairly as it's possible to do it. I think our administrators were wonderful people. I served with a man there called Hugh Foote. Hugh Foote is now Lord Caradon. And he eventually became our representative, our ambassador to the United Nations, or the League of Nations, whatever it was. In fact, he was the man who supported Resolution 242 on the partition of Palestine. An excellent administrator. I'm not a great believer in honour, but you could describe Hugh Foote as a man of honour and a fair man. And I think Hugh Foote was... The Arabs that looked upon Hugh Foote as a fair man, they didn't hold things against him personally, I'm quite sure of that. I only say that because I escorted him on one or two occasions, and when he met Arab people, not the peasants, but the more senior Arab people who had some influence, they always seemed to get on extremely well. And I think they looked upon Hugh Foote as a very fair sort of chap, you know. And of course he was a complete gentleman. Who, no matter who he dealt with, he was a gentleman. But I think the League of Nations gave Britain a job which we really didn't want. And I think in 1940 we're glad to get rid of.
Were you happy or unhappy in Palestine?
Oh, no, I was perfectly happy. I enjoyed it. I liked Palestine. It's a wonderful country. Wonderful climate. Nice people. Wonderful people. Honest people. Apart from shooting at you now and again, but... I'm very fond of Arabs.
How much danger, personal danger, did you feel in?
I think at the age I was when I went there, I was 20. And I don't think you think much about personal danger. When an incident occurs, you realise that you could have been injured or killed. But at that age, by next day you've forgotten about it. But I think we realised there was danger all the time, particularly when, in 1937, we were losing so many British policemen, because that was a very bad year. There were an awful lot of policemen being killed. I worked in the Old City in Jerusalem for about 3 months. I lived in the Old City, and we did foot patrol at night there and in the daytime. And suddenly you would have one of your colleagues killed. So you knew when you went out that you were in danger. But it was an acceptable danger. That's what you were paid for. Like a soldier, you're paid to face these things, you see. It didn't affect me a lot at all, just as it didn't affect me during the war.
Did you have any narrow escapes?
I don't know whether I had any narrow escapes or not, because I might have had a narrow escape and didn't realise it. We would do patrols at night on the road between Haifa and Tel Aviv, for example, and a mine would go off. Or the road would be blocked, because they would put stones across the road so that it would stop your vehicle and hope you would jump out of the vehicle and expose yourself and that sort of thing. But very quickly we were trained in the correct action to take. With the Arabs, they were very clever. They would build a roadblock, fire on a police vehicle and disappear. They were gone. They didn't wait to get your reaction, because our reaction was, we were trained to take a certain reaction. They weren't properly armed as we were. They didn't have automatic weapons. And our reaction, if they'd stayed where they were, we'd have killed them. We might have lost somebody, but we'd have killed them. So they didn't do that. They went. They disappeared into thin air. So if you get in a position like that where you might say the next day, well, that was a narrow squeak. But you didn't really know whether it was or not. But you took that in your stride. You didn't worry about it. You went and had your dinner at night or your lunch and went and had a pint of beer or a couple of glasses of whiskey. And you went to bed and you slept soundly.
As a policeman there, what did you think to the role of the British Army? Do you think they were effective, or were they just run rings round?
Well, it's only a personal opinion. And it's in hindsight. And it's by seeing what happened during the war and how you deploy troops and what you do with troops and how you go into action and what you do. The army wasn't trained to do that job. They were bottled up in barracks. And then they would be sent out, a platoon or a company, to roam all over the hills and then go back to barracks. And sometimes I thought it was a futile exercise. I don't think they got any special training in anti-terrorist tactics as they do nowadays. Troops are trained nowadays in these tactics. But they were necessary. It was necessary to have them there.
Can you tell me about how you came back from Palestine?
Well, the reason I came back was, the main reason I came back was it was quite obvious to me there was going to be a war. I was quite convinced about that. And those of us that were in Palestine were convinced there was going to be a war for one or two reasons. One was the aggressiveness of the German propaganda. The other was the stories that we were told by Jewish people who came from Germany and other countries where Germans had invaded. It's a peculiar thing. I've never liked to listen or believe in terror stories, because the stories we were told after the First World War, most of them were disproved. So that initially we disbelieved a lot of stories, but of course eventually we understood the truth in these things. But the things that people told us who came to Palestine assured us that something was brewing up that wasn't going to be stopped unless a war broke out. Nothing to do with Poland or anything like that, because that hadn't come into the picture by that time, but it was quite obvious that Germany was getting to the stage where eventually somebody would have to stop them. And I was quite convinced. I didn't know when the war was coming. I thought it would be coming quicker than it did. But I was quite convinced it was coming. And then there was a rumour that the Palestine police was going to be turned into an infantry battalion. And that horrified me, because we weren't trained as infantrymen. The rank structure was quite wrong. You couldn't take a whole police force of men and say to a superintendent of police, well, you're now a captain, and somebody else, you're a major, because they weren't trained to be do jobs like that. So that horrified me. It was quite untrue, of course, the rumours, but there you are. But my main reason for coming by was the fact that I was quite convinced a war was going to break out. And if it was, I wanted to be back in this country so that I could go into the army. And having made my mind up about that, I very reluctantly resigned and came back.
Was it easy to get out?
Oh, yes, yes. I just put in a note and said I wish to resign. And they, I got a reply to tell me that my resignation would take effect from a certain date, which was a month ahead of that. And I'd arranged my own passage back, of course. And I just went down to the docks at Haifa and bought a ticket on a boat from Haifa to Avonmouth, carrying oranges, and came back on that boat. No difficulty.
Now, I think you were telling me earlier that you came back to Britain to work on aircraft production.
No, I didn't come back specifically to do that. I came back and and I had to find a job. And initially I went back to Glasgow, but decided to come to Liverpool because I had one or two relatives there. I came to Liverpool and the first opportunity of a job was to wash cars at night. So that's what I did. And after having done that for some time, I got very ambitious then and thought I'd look for a better job. And as I say, I went to this aircraft factory in Speke, where I saw this huge queue, and gave up the ghost. But I cycled to the entrance of the factory and saw a chap in the uniform of the Corps of Commissioners who I'd served with in Palestine. And we recognised each other, and he asked me what I wanted, and I said I was looking for a job, and he said, well, we only want skilled men here. And he took me in, and I was presented to this fat chap in an office who handed me a blueprint without any markings on it on the outside, asked me what it was, and handed it to me upside down, and I turned it round the right way up, and within a very short space of time, I was employed in the factory. And I stayed there until mobilisation happened.
Can you tell me about the work that you were doing there?
Well, I was employed as a fitter, initially, building wings. The The component parts for the wings came into a department, and the fitters working on the wings assembled the parts and riveted the whole wing together. Then that was taken away and fitted by other men to the aircraft, the fuselage. But eventually I went on to what we described as snags, where we worked on defects on an aircraft. If a rivet had been put in wrong, we took it out. If an aircraft had been damaged, the skin had been damaged, we repaired the skin. And we worked on that until the job was finished. Anything on the aircraft at all except the electrical system, the men working on snags did it. They repaired the snags.
How much pressure was there on the workforce to increase production?
Wasn't any pressure brought to bear on us by the management. The reason we increased production was because we were allowed to work the hours we wanted to and as many as we wanted to, and because of the pay.
So what kind of hours were you working personally?
Well, for long periods of time, we would start very early in the morning, 6:30, 7 o'clock, and we could work through if we wanted to until 10 o'clock at night. And also, if we wanted to, we worked Saturdays and Sundays.
Did trade unions try to interfere with that?
No. I don't think that the workforce would have tolerated any interference, because they, for the first time, they were getting a lot of money. And I don't think there was any incidents with the trade unions at all. I didn't belong to a trade union myself, of course, but I don't know of any interference by trade unions.
What was the name of the firm?
Roots Securities.
Roots?
Roots, yeah.
R-O-O-T-E-S.
That's right.
And did you know the names of the types of aircraft you were working on?
We worked on the short-nosed Blenheim.
We were talking earlier about the kind of riveting that was done. Can you tell me again what you told me earlier?
Yes. When we riveted, the rivets were in boxes, and each box had a different colour. And you could only use the rivets in a box for 1 hour. And then you had to take the rivets back. They were kept in a refrigerator. And you would...